Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Today, we're going to be talking about the Cascadia subduction zone, about earthquakes, especially about tsunamis, and about what we can do as individuals and as a coastal community to stay safe. Today, we'll hear part one of a two-part program. The second part will be broadcast in this same time slot next month, more specifically on Monday, September 11th at 9:30 a.m. Our guest is Patrick Corcoran. He's the coastal hazard specialist for Oregon State University, and he's recently back from a second trip to Japan after their 2011 tsunami. But we'll let Patrick tell you a little about himself.
I work for Oregon State University, and my office is here in the Clatsop County OSU Extension Office, along with about almost a dozen other faculty and program assistants doing a wide range of things, from the ever-famous 4-H program to food and nutrition to forestry and fishing and master gardeners, of course. And my area is coastal hazards. Mm-hmm. And I have a master's degree in geography from Oregon State University, and I am an associate professor in the department in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. In December 26th of 2004, the Boxing Day earthquake and tsunamis in Sumatra in the Indonesian Ocean occurred. And, you know, all seismologists and all geologists and all professionals who'd worked in the area of tsunamis had never seen one before. That was the first visual recording of the subduction zone-generated tsunami. And we were all, like, looking at each other with eyes wide open, like, oh, my goodness. You know, in theory, we knew about it, but that was real. So it was a big shakeup to the entire profession. So starting in January of 2005, I added to my coastal hazards about chronic hazards, like coastal storms program, the catastrophic hazard that we face, which is this Cascadia subduction zone, earthquake, and tsunamis. And that's been the large part of my work since then, is wrapping our head around that and what can we do about it.
Now, the awareness of the Cascadia subduction zone actually is fairly recent, is it not? Isn't that within the last 50 years or so that we've become aware of this?
This is the most amazing thing, Roger. There is no other population of people on the planet who has not experienced their region's recurring worst natural disaster. Since Western settlement, we haven't experienced this in the Pacific Northwest. Native Americans who were here in 1700 and before that had a wide variety of oral traditions about earthquakes and tsunamis and some instructions. One included to weave long ropes. So when you felt the big earthquake, you could tie one end of that long rope to the front of your canoe, the other end around a sturdy tree. You and your family would get in the canoe, and as the water rose, your canoe would rise. And if you were good in the winter months making a long rope, your rope would be long enough so you could ride out that tsunami. Mm-hmm. That's just one story. Is that is it metaphorical maybe for these things happen? We need to prepare in a multiple of ways. But there was oral tradition. They didn't need to be convinced that this happens here. Same thing in Japan. The vast majority of my job is trying to dance around and convince people that this will happen again.
Well, what is the Cascadia subduction zone?
Excellent question. It is one of a number of subduction zones across the planet, and the subduction zone refers to the way the fault line lies. Many are familiar with the San Andreas Fault in California, and if you were to put your hands together, index finger to index finger, and move them side by side along each other, that is that strike-slip fault kind of structure. Mm-hmm. What we have is different. Starting at the Mendocino line of California, basically the California border, begins the southern part of this subduction zone. And think of it as an overlap. It's almost like a burrito. And so when people ask, where is it? Oftentimes it's said it's 70 miles offshore. Well, that's true, but it's an overlap. And so 70 miles offshore is the western edge of this big overlap. The eastern edge of this big overlap is underneath the Cascade Range. It is a function of that, those two plates moving towards each other head on, and the ocean plate is heavier than the land plate, and so it subducts underneath the North American continent, and it's kind of like an inchworm process. You know, I've got my hands like on top of each other now, and my knuckles are moving like an inchworm across the other. So it's a fundamentally different type of fault than California faults.
So the Pacific plate is forever moving eastward.
Correct.
and it comes up against the continental plate,
yep,
about 70 miles offshore,
mm-hmm,
and it has to go somewhere,
yep,
and it goes under.
The ocean floor is actually a denser kind of rock, so mm-hmm, when two big things meet, the heavier one subducts down, and that's the ocean floor, correct?
So what happens that brings about eventually an earthquake?
Amazingly, it is the relaxation of the earth. So right now we've got these plates that are, you know, kind of moving towards each other at about the same length as your fingernails grow per mm-hmm year, which isn't a lot. But since it's been 317 years since the last one, you can imagine your fingernails after 317 years, you know, there's going to be pressure. And so that pressure distorts the land and it pushes it up. So when they do measurements of Highway 101 from north to south with very accurate devices, they can measure the amount of uplift, tectonic uplift, that this geologic feature is creating. So Highway 101 is rising, interestingly, at about the same rate as sea level rise is rising. So on the Oregon coast, we have this overlapping plate, and it is smooshing up the coast 101, kind of north to south. At some point, it gets to as far as it can go, and it, boof, it erupts.
Mm-hmm.
And so that inchworm then with an arch back becomes an inchworm with a flat back. And that's the subduction part. So what is our experience? Well, when that happens, it's a very long earthquake. You know, 3 to 5 minutes. The Loma Prieta in 87 in California was 30 seconds, and it felt like forever to people. So when that happens, during those 3 to 5 minutes, that the earth, that inchworm kind of feature, is flattening, mm-hmm, and at the same time, it is generating an eruption out in the ocean that disturbs the sea floor, which pushes a column of water up, and then that column of water, just like dropping a stone in a pond, propagates out, mm-hmm, and that is the tsunami. So we have this overlapping fault. It builds up pressure. The pressure releases. On the coast, we drop down 3 to 6 feet, but offshore 70 miles, like the other side of that equation, is that tips up.
Mm-hmm.
And when that tips up, that creates a tsunami. So we get a triple whammy within a short period of time of an earthquake, during which time we are subsiding and dropping down, which means our water table is coming up 3 to 6 feet. And in mm-hmm some places, that's a lot. That's also our natural warning that in 15 to 30 minutes, we can expect tsunamis to arrive at the ocean shore, at the beach. So it's a boom, 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 boom. It goes from a beautiful sunny day like today, and it could go real bad real quick.
Now, we know now how often this has happened over quite a period of time. How do we know that? How do we read the record?
It's an amazing story. And so here representing scientists, I have to have some egg on my face. I mean, up until the late 1980s, there was a question. The question was, how can we have all these mountains? How can we live on a subduction zone and not have big earthquakes like everybody else on a subduction zone? Japan, Chile, Indonesia, I mean, all kinds of places. So why is ours quiet? Well, the primary theory at the time was, well, those plates going over each other must be well lubricated, and they're just sort of sliding by, and that's why we don't have great earthquakes, but we have mountains and things like that. And so scientists are, you know, kind of picking at that theory and saying, well, it could be this, and that's what science does. Someone puts out a theory with some evidence, seems to make sense, and other scientists try to pick it apart and try to break it, make it not work, to try to prove them wrong. And that's how good ideas emerge in science. It's not because one genius woke up in the middle of the night. It's somebody had 100 of his colleagues pick it apart, or her colleagues pick it apart, and what is left standing is what people agree on as the science. So it took a while to do that here.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it took till the late 1980s to understand that when we get these things regularly in geologic time. One of the first indicators were what's known as the sunken forests that we can see as we drive up and down the coast all the way from British Columbia down to California, in areas that were kind of in estuaries and wetland areas that were marshes, that were woody marshes at the time with western red cedar, maybe 3 feet, you know, off the bay. The earthquake happens, subsidence happens, so that water table comes up 3 to 6 feet. Now you've got a forest that's up to its knees in water. Well, they don't like that, so they die. But the part underwater is preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we found hundreds of years later are these stumps, these western red cedar stumps, like they all, the same thing happened at the same time. Couldn't figure out why until around the 1990s. Brian Atwater, a U.S. Geological Survey researcher from the Seattle area, was up in the Palix River in Washington and was noticing these forests. And at that time, they were coming up against the, it must just be well lubricated and that's why we don't get earthquakes. That just didn't sit right. So he was asking, well, what could have caused this? Well, what this is consistent with, this sunken forest, is a subduction of a subduction zone earthquake. And it's like, huh, well, this, if that's what that is, this would be evidence that, in fact, we do get great earthquakes and tsunamis. And simultaneously, since the late 80s and 90s and now, the ability of devices to observe and for modeling and to determine histories and dates has just come along tremendously. So we've been benefited by the technological advances. So they went through a variety of them to find out how old are these trees. And they looked at the tree rings, and that got them down to a certain carbon dating, got them within maybe a 20-year period around 1700, 1680 to 1720. Then they looked at the rings on the roots of these western red cedars and counted. And what they determined was these trees survived the summer of 1699, but not the summer of 1700. So that dendrochronology brought down the refinement of when that event happened, to a year.
Mm-hmm.
That then led to the research with Japan, and they said, oh, well, hey, right around that time we had this tsunami show up that didn't precede with an earthquake. That was weird for us. And figured out, huh, that was yours, Oregon. Thanks a lot for sending us that tsunami.
Because a tsunami goes out in all directions.
It does.
It doesn't just go one way.
Correct.
Your stone in the pond analogy, mm-hmm. I think, fits there.
Yeah, it fits in general. I mean, more technically, they tend to be perpendicular to the fault line. So our fault line is almost due north and south, that western edge of it under the ocean. And so when the earthquake generates a tsunami here, the bulk of the energy goes east and west.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we're only 70 miles east of
right.
that energy. Japan is 5,000 miles to the west, if not more. And so, like in 2011, when Japan had their big earthquake and tsunamis, we received what we call a distant tsunami, and it wasn't very big. You know, mm-hmm. these once they go across the ocean, a lot of the oomph goes away. If it happens under your feet, you're all about the oomph. And that's what we haven't experienced here in the Northwest. But getting back to how we know, they advanced okay. So we've got some trees, we've got some sunken forests, you know, need more data. Chris Goldfinger at Oregon State University got the idea and the funding to do a project that did core samples in the offshore canyons all the way from Canada down to California. So people might be familiar with the Astoria Canyon. The river flows out of the mouth of the river and goes into the ocean. And if you can look at a map of the ocean floor, you'll see there are deep canyons at various places, kind of like under ocean rivers. And what was determined was when these large subduction zone earthquake happens, it shakes so much that the material on the sides of that canyon sloughs down to the bottom of the canyon. A couple hundred years goes by, no earthquakes, the sediment builds up, regular normal seafloor, big old subduction zone earthquake, material sloughs off the sides, and it creates these layers on the floor of the canyon reflecting the number of times and the relative size of the sloughing. Hmm. And research with lots of others has corroborated that evidence with some onshore evidence. Do these core samples match with what we're finding in terms of layers of sand on shore? And sure enough, you know, so it has been scientifically vetted as an indicator and an index of the events that we've had. So big question, how many have we had? In the last 10,000 years, there have been 42, for sure, subduction zone events. 42. Not four, not two in the last 10,000 years. 42.
Right.
So that's a big deal. So these things happen here. They happen regularly in geologic time. We just been here in a gap. And just because Pat Corcoran bought a house in Astoria, that doesn't mean that this process stops.
Right.
You know? and so we are culturally really behind the ball on this, and it's tough.
Now, the time span between these events varies greatly, does it not?
I make an analogy with winter storms. We can say some things pretty generally and highly accurate about winter storms. I can tell you next year we're going to have three events that we'll call winter storms. It will mean winds above 30 miles an hour. It means more than an inch of rain in 24 hours. I guarantee you we're going to have three of those next winter. Now, I can't tell you what date. I can't tell you maximum wind speeds on that date. But you would be well advised to understand we're going to have three winter storms next year. They're all different. Okay, winter storms. You can say on average winter storms are like this, but the fact is these earthquakes and tsunamis, like winter storms, are all different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're similar in a general case in that they're all magnitude 8 or magnitude 9 earthquakes, but they're each different in how those earthquakes actually tweak the earth.
And just as a reminder, a magnitude 9 would be 10 times stronger than a magnitude 8. Is that not so, or?
It's worse. It's worse. Like 30 times. It's a multiplier, a logarithmic equation. So, these numbers are generally right, but say you have a magnitude 7 and then a magnitude 8 would be 30 times worse than the 7. A magnitude 9 would be a 30 times 30 worse than a 7.
No.
So, yeah, it's not like a little bit worse. It's really bad. That is important, Roger, though, because what we found in the last 10,000 years, there have been 42 plus or minus of these events. They've been basically evenly between magnitude 8 and magnitude 9.
Mm-hmm.
What we now that we finally are catching up to this hazard in terms of our planning are focusing on, it's the New Yorker scenario, the magnitude 9 plus worst case scenario. And if you're in a planning profession, you need to worry about the worst case scenario, as unlikely as it is. Far more equally likely would be a magnitude 8,
mm-hmm.
which would make our scenario bad but not ugly and a whole lot more manageable for people and institutions to deal with. So what we know is we get these regularly. We know it's been 317 years since the last one. The next one, when it comes, will be on some spectrum, just like the last ones. You know, all I care about is the next event,
right.
Really. So when you talk about long-term averages, that's interesting, but all I care about is the next event. So there is high variability in how bad they are. They're either eights or nines, but even that is on a spectrum. These eights and nines generate tsunamis based on the actual tweaking of the Earth, and so there's variability in those as well. So stop asking for precise answers to precise questions and understand that we're well within the realm of possibility of this happening. 75% of them have happened by 317 years into the cycle. We need to take this seriously. These happen here regularly, and we are very much behind the curve on this. We have not experienced this since Western settlement. Unlike Japan, we don't have grandparents that have been through something like this that keep us focused on it.
Right.
So there's high variability, but a key point I want to make is we're all going through the stages of grief, denial, anger, depression, bargaining with the devil, and acceptance, okay? And if we can say, yeah, but there's been a 1,000-year gap between these, wow, that's my bargaining with the devil. Please, God, have us be in a 1,000-year gap.
Right.
If we have a South Coast magnitude 8, everybody in this story is going to feel it and is going to go through the duck cover and hold all along the coast. It will be felt in Portland. Everybody's going to do the same thing as if it was a 9. And so this business that these gaps exist, I think, is false, because you're going to feel a magnitude 8 on the South Coast anywhere in the region. Mm-hmm. Things will break.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the more frequent recurrence interval is the real one we have to worry about. And I think it's misleading to suggest 500 to 1,000 years have been gaps. The key point here, I think, Roger, is the next event is more likely than we think. But the next event is probably going to be less bad than we're imagining right now.
Sure.
Okay. It's like if the only storm you experienced was a 2007 storm, you know, and all this, which was a lights out, literally, type of storm. You know, you get fixated on this worst case scenario and it can be counterproductive.
So what have we done to prepare so far? And I know we're going to talk about Japan in a moment, and you're going to say not nearly enough by many leagues. But what have we done so far to prepare?
There have been some important kinds of things. The most important is the Oregon Resilience Plan, which was a statewide effort to identify policies that could help mitigate, make less bad, or adapt to, live our lives knowing that this is going to happen. That's good. Each of the counties in the state, but certainly I'm focusing on the coast, have county emergency management professionals now. We have Tiffany Brown here in Clatsop County. All of the police and fire people have had this kind of training and things like that. And so in the safety professions, there has definitely been a shot across the bow and thou shalt and all kinds of trainings for folks. At the individual level, People are savvy about go bags, and they're identifying, you know, evacuation routes that fill in a tsunami. So there is, I think, a bell-shaped curve of individuals. There are some individuals that, good grief, I'm envious of their go bag, right? And there's a whole bunch of people that will never do anything to prepare. Mm-hmm. So what I focus on is the group in the middle that kind of do what your neighbors do. And we are certainly not on the Oregon coast anywhere near a tipping point where thinking about and being resilient and spending resources preparing for this is evident at all. The big gap I see is municipalities and political leadership. I mean, it is absolutely inappropriate for any mayor or manager of the city to say, hey, police and fire, this is a bummer for you because this really gives you a lot of work, both before, during, and after. Check that box.
Yeah.
No. One thing I learned in Japan was that the mayors of cities are the ultimate authority in disasters, and they're the ones who have to make decisions about life and death, about evacuation shelters, where resources go from the federal government, where they don't go. So this is my big thing here is moving from individuals to systems. And up until this point, and it's been 10 years, okay, it's been individuals. An individual in a department is kind of gets on the bus. An individual somewhere else in their house, in their neighborhood, does something. Yeah, in Japan, it is a system of preparedness. And the only way we can be prepared commensurate to this huge risk is to shift this from onesie-twosie individual actions that can be taken to this is what our public policy directs. And we're not there. We're treating this like a marginal inconvenience, and especially the development community is very much not interested in talking about it. But I think we're at the cusp in our culture and on the coast that we need to make some very wonderful decisions about how we develop the coast.
Well, tell me about the trip to Japan and what brought that about. And obviously, it affected you very strongly. So I'd like to hear about that.
It was my second trip. And so in February of 2012, I went to the Tohoku region in Japan, which is the region that got hit. So Sendai, we saw the black waves coming across those greenhouses in the airport there and north. And in 2011, it was with geologists and seismologists asking the question, what happened? You know, what was the shake? How high did the water come up? This, that, and the other. And that was an interesting, heartbreaking tour. 5 years later, just this last April, I was invited to go with a Greater Portland Incorporated study mission. And interestingly, the group was basically the Port of Portland, who is going through a $1 billion renovation of the airport. They wanted to go to Sendai to find out, how did you do such a good job on your airport? You had military planes flying in 4 days later and commercial air traffic within a month. Mm-hmm. So this group was economic development types asking, how can we thrive in an area of subduction zone earthquakes and tsunamis? So very interesting, different sets of trips and 5 years between them. And I've come back basically, I don't have to go to Japan anymore. There's no analog there for us. The choice that the Japanese have made is a choice that we cannot make. The level of engineering and engineered structures and systems behind which our facilities is truly impressive. As a public works effort, it is absolutely mind-boggling. In Oregon, we cannot afford and would never permit, as far as environmental permits, the level of engineering they do in Japan.
We all remember from watching the video of what happened in Japan, the seawalls they had built, and unfortunately miscalculated in a way because the tsunami breached those seawalls in some places. But that's not something that's going to happen here.
Never.
Yeah.
No. Culturally, so Japan is a island the size of California. It has 135 million people. California has 35, 37 million people. Mm-hmm. So size of California with 100 million more people than California, mostly concentrated in the urban areas around Tokyo and in the south and southwest. They can afford to engineer the heck out of everything. So they've got a lot of wealthy people on a small island with the coast. We in Oregon have a small number of middle-class people, and there's no way we can... The town Rikuzen Takeda was the main community I'm thinking of now. It is a population of 20,000 people. It reminded me very much of Tillamook, in Tillamook Bay, What they're doing there, if you can imagine for Tillamook Bay, would be to start at Cape Mears at the south and build a 35-foot seawall. Now, for the seawall to be 35 feet high, it has to be about 300 feet at the base. Okay, so these are large. From Cape Mears all the way across the spit, like where Bay Ocean used to be, all the way to where the Tillamook Bay empties into the ocean, at which case the seawall would stop, and they put in a large tide gate that blocks off the river. And this is between the community and the ocean. So I don't anticipate a whole lot of excitement about that.
Right.
Now, Japan is a place that doesn't need to be convinced that they have earthquakes and tsunamis. The mall just opened when we were there visiting after 5 years, and there was a big fundraising event there by these people that got completely destroyed in the tsunami, collecting funds for another community in Japan that just had a series of earthquakes. So this is a population that deals with this. We're not.
If somebody lives here and lives up on a hill in Astoria, they may think that, well, I'm probably okay.
Yeah.
But with an 8 or 9 earthquake, how okay will you be living on a hill in Astoria?
The elevation is good. I like that. Of course,
in
Astoria, in Tillamook, and in this listening area, there are a lot of steep slopes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the earthquake creates landslides. And so you don't even know if your neighborhood is. So there's that whole piece. But the other thing about that is we drive in and out of inundation zones all day long.
Right.
You know, to drive from Seaside to Astoria, I mean, you're going in and out of them. So I think it is part of that. The fact that we have never experienced this since Western settlement, that we can actually say, well, I live at 200 feet, so I'll be fine. And I'm talking to these people at the Peter Iredale. This is unpredictable. This is like musical chairs. We do not know when the music is going to stop. So for me, I'm conscious about the amount of time in the zone. I go surfing, I go on the beach, I go climbing. I do all the things everybody else does, but I probably have a bit more of a clock in my brain about, you know, when I'm at the observation kiosk at the South Jetty, I'm at the very limit of what I think I can do as far as getting to the KOA, which is the high ground from that location.
Mm-hmm.
So living on the coast, we need to bring a savviness to where we are, and not only where we are, but where we would go if we felt an earthquake at that moment. Now, there's enough high ground around here that that's not very far. But you need to think about that before the earthquake happens. Someone mentioned that, you know, in a big earthquake like that, everybody loses 100 IQ points right off the bat, right? Because you're traumatized, you're scared, like fight or flight kicks in. So we need to have thought through these things beforehand, and we need to ritualize these things. We need to identify where that high ground is and put picnic shelters up there, or that's where we do our evacuation drills. If you're somewhere bad and you can get in your car and drive somewhere good, for goodness sakes, do that. The instruction is not to, for a number of reasons. One, the odds of you crunching your car or falling into a chasm or filling up with water are pretty high. But if it's your only option, it's your only option.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, people tend to think, you know, a siren will go off, I'll get in my car and drive to Portland. I mean, we haven't experienced the earthquake tsunami 1-2 punch, and so the hardest thing is programming ourselves about the reality of the situation.
That's the Human Beat for today. We'll continue our discussion with coastal hazard specialist Patrick Corcoran in the second half of this program. We'll talk more about tsunamis and about what we all can do to prepare ourselves, our families, and our communities. That will be broadcast next month, September 11th at 9:30 a.m. I'm Roger Rucka. Thanks for listening.